Killer Keller podcast. KillerKellerOfficial.com.
You need the Kellervision app. 24/7 mini documentaries, podcasts, live shows, DJ live streams, top fives, subscription packages, plus products for all your podcasts and street culture sports. Download it from the App Store for free today.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
Second time.
Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller podcast, live and direct, not in central London. We are on location, power on now. Welcome, everybody. Hope you're having a good morning. Big shout out to graffitikings.co.uk, holding on the fort. Big shout out to people with the Kellervision app, free download for your street culture needs. Android, Apple, you know what it is. Get involved. We are on location, a little bit outside of Blackpool, into the headquarters of one of the pioneering turntablists of the UK and the world. Not just the Battle Supremo, not just the Battle Tool creator, but part of a bigger scene, a cottage industry scene of the mods, of the porter table industry, which is coming and burgeoning and creating a new generation of DJ turntablists in the wake. The mighty DJ Woody inside the place. How are you, my brother?
I'm very well, man.
Thank you so much for having us here. If you aren't watching and you're listening, behind us here is a plethora of different records and collect. I mean, we are in the HQ hub of the DJ Woody. This is
right in the lab.
This is your life. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, man.
And you're outside of Blackpool. This is.
Yeah, we're on Costerdale, Lancashire. Here on a nice sunny day.
I can't believe I'm here. I mean, I see so much of it online. You know, the whole social media, you feel like you're ever present, but to actually be here in this current state of affairs,
in the pit, yeah. it's nice to have you, man.
How long did it take to accumulate? How long, you know, to create such an environment to create from?
What, records wise, yeah. Or just?
Wow. I mean, dude. I mean, again, if you're not watching and you're listening, there is a lot going on here. You've got turntables on one side, speakers, products. Skateboards, how long did it take to amass this?
I'm a bit of a hoarder, but I mean, I've been buying records since I was a kid, like, you know, yeah. Sort of, I think, yeah, I used to buy everything on cassette, and then I remember there was a certain Run DMC album that came out that I could only get on vinyl, and I wanted it on cassette, but I got it on vinyl, and from that point onwards, everything was vinyl. So yeah, and yeah, 7-inch records were the cheapest from Woolies back in the day as well, man. So
hold tight to Woolworths crew. If you're not from the UK, you want to think what we're talking about there. Woolworths was the spot, man.
Yeah, man. You get all the singles for a couple of quid. So yeah, all my sort of first hip hop singles were all on 7 and stuff, you know. So yeah, man. Just a massive fan and massive music fan. So yeah, forever.
Yeah. We spoke about this on the car on the way up, and you and me share a very similar. Walk of our youth when the American side of, well, the Americanism, the export of America came over to the UK in the mid-90s in such a way. I mean, now it's just a given, but, you know, there was the skateboarding, there was the DJing, the hip-hop as a whole, combined with just that capitalist world.
Well, yeah, Malcolm McLaren, you know, he brought it over as a package, didn't he? Do you know what I mean? So
you have this almost, you know.
Yeah, like I just remember, well, I mean, to be honest with you, I remember not being that into music to a certain point when I was a kid because nothing shouted at me, do you know what I mean? Like there was New Wave out, like I wasn't into A-ha or Duran Duran or whatever, you know what I mean? Liked a bit of Adamant and a bit of Madness, but then boom, do you know what I mean? Like, you see Run DMC, like, people are breaking at the school disco. Like, there's graffiti on, like, down the street from me, you know. There's people popping and whatnot outside the cinema in Burnley, you know. All of a sudden, there's this cool thing that's, like, seems all together as a package, you know what I mean?
And it called you, didn't it? It was like, this is a calling thing.
Yeah, I don't know what chord, it struck a massive chord, you know. Like, I'm a little bit, like, I think we're about a similar age, innit? But, like, I'm a couple of years younger than your typical first-gen UK hip-hop lot, do you know what I mean? But I've got an older brother. So it was, like, people in his class, like, you know, could throw down a windmill or show you how to do floats or whatever, or, you know, had a big case of cassettes that you could sort of tape to tape, you know what I mean? So it was just all that, really. I just always kind of jumped on the stuff that my brother was exposed to, and kind of, like I say, yeah, the skateboarding and the hip hop just, yes, just spoke to me.
It's funny that everyone needs a conduit, don't they? They need a person that will almost like an enabler.
Yeah, massively. Like, I think, me and my brother are actually pretty dissimilar, but like growing up, you know, we, to a large extent, latched onto the same stuff. Do you know what I mean? I think particularly with the hip hop stuff, I kind of, at some point I realised that I wanted to actually do this thing. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Rather than just being a fan of Run DMC, and Eric B and Rakim, and you know, everything. Like, you know, yeah, I wanted to write a rap. I wanted to make a beat. I wanted to scratch. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I wanted to do it all. So it's at a certain point, you know, where if friends sort of seem to get into other stuff, I realise that, you know, yeah, I want to do this thing, you know.
Yeah, and make it contribute. I think that's one thing when I think of DJ Woody, and for those of you that don't know, like, we're talking levels of world champion scratch DJing here. That this guy here he's pioneered sounds and styles and retrained people's idea of scratching into a musical addition to the instrumental tapestry, haven't you?
Thank you, dude. I mean, that's, yeah, the musician side of it has kind of really always been important to me, probably from the basis of hearing, you know, Run and DMC talk about Jam Master Jay in the context of him being their band. Do you know what I mean? And then obviously, you know, when Rocksteady DJs came out, do you know what I mean? There were three of them, you know, Wrecking Shop as a band, you know, one's doing the drums and you know, so with the guys I came up with, that was our tact. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was a few of us, and you know, that's what we were trying to do. And then, sort of, yeah, like sort of mid late 90s, we had a jam night in Manchester where the turntables were the lead instrument, and we had musicians around us, and we'd freestyle for the last two hours of the night. You know,
That's mad. So yeah, so you really, it almost was like a whole total package. Just landing in,
just the way it's gone, and just kind of like the things, the things that really spoke to me were that just the, for the artistry. Do you know what I mean? Like, we talk about the turntables and musical instrument. You know, we've always had to battle to get that recognition. You know, and you know, if you can contribute something that strengthens that argument, do you know what I mean? Like, because I believe it, but like, You know, your mum and dad ain't going to believe you until you show them that, look, you know, I can be just as dexterous as a guitar player here, and I can flip this sound in ways you weren't expecting. Do you know what I mean? And that's kind of the magic. Do you know what I mean?
Like, what does your mum and dad, because let's get into the growing up side of this, because I know you're a skateboarder as well. What did your mum and dad at the time, though, even up till now, think of the way that you have, because you've represented it in a particular way, and you've gone with your gut and put what you've been thinking all the while into fruition. It's a thing now. Like, what do they think?
I don't know, to be honest with you. Like, I think my dad, I mean, the hip hop thing from, you know, my mum busting in my room, like, sort of, you know, mimicking Run DMC lyrics on, you know, into a hairbrush and all that lot. You know, I think back in the day, you know, it's like typical, oh, it's a fad, you know, whatever is into. And then, you know, it comes to sort of 10 years later when I'm actually, you know, sort of doing this thing and getting out there, and then, you know, the crunch point, you know, I'm thinking of quitting my job, you know, and, you know, doing all this. I'm not sure, really. I don't think they really, because they kind of don't really get it. Like, it's just kind of been on the periphery. Okay, that's what he does. It seems to be working. He's paying his bills. Yeah, do you know what I mean? I think it's a bit of a sort of anomaly for them, really. They don't really,
And I suppose as a kid, again, you know, just going back to the skating and stuff and where you came from growing up, then to have a laser focus on what you wanted to do and actually channel your pocket money or your, you know, your income at a young age into creating what is a catalogue of records. Some crazy, I mean, moving forward, but, you know, back in the day, I'm sure they were pretty content knowing that you were just into what you were into and you were doing it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, I was kind of always an art kid, so I was always into kind of creative stuff, you know what I mean? And that was encouraged, you know, and I kind of excelled in that, you know. And I think I kind of tried to take through that. I think I learned that if I committed myself to learning something and practicing it, then I realized that you can kind of get to where you want with it. Do you know what I mean? And that was kind of probably instilled from the art. So when it came to turntables, I think I looked at it in the same light as my limit is only limited to my dedication so far as what I can achieve with it. And that's not being cocky, that's just knowing that hard work pays.
Yeah.
And dedication pays and
that's
patience.
That shit, see.
Yeah, man. So like, so I never necessarily looked at a DJ and thought I couldn't get to that level. I just knew that it was going to take some work. Yeah. You know, and from that it's using your own kind of creativity and ideas and thinking and also approach, like how you approach something that can advance where you go with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like not limiting yourself and sort of the ethos that you take to an art form, you know, setting yourself challenges and, you know, sort of thinking out of the box.
Yeah.
Thinking for yourself and avoiding what the pack are doing and all those kind of ideas, man. Just, I just love it to this day.
It's interesting when you say the pack, because over the time, now we're getting into an era of the scratch perverts were most definitely holding court. This was like the golden era of, I don't know, but it was certainly, there was a momentum riding on the new turntablism phenomenon, you know?
Yeah.
And, individuality was key. You going into those arenas, you just had to be unique and you had to be holding court, didn't you, you know?
I think the UK scene, sort of the late 90s, like, it's one of the strongest scenes in the world, you know, like, Q and Mike and everybody came over for Fresh 97, like, a couple of years earlier, the Perverts were coming up. Creatively, like, what was going on in the UK, particularly at that time, you know, after the sort of mid-90s, well, it was still booming, you know, you still had Craze, obviously, in 98, 99, P-Tricks, and there was so much creativity everywhere.
Yeah, mad.
And it was, so to choose or to be at the level within, you know, sort of your sort of, to be a DJ at that time, to be a battling DJ of that time, coming up in that era, it did force you to work doubly hard, you know, because like the creativity was off the scale. Every year people were coming with new stuff, you know, like I used to go to all the UK finals, certainly all the Manchester finals I could get to from, you know, early mid-90s, early 90s on. And, you know, every year, you know, there'd be a new thing, you know, XL did a twiddle and that was like the first multiple finger, you know, fader technique I'd ever seen. And
that's,
it's like,
crazy.
Oh my God, like he's using another finger on the fader and it's doing it double time. And then the Q comes with the crab.
Yeah.
And then I see, you know, Prime Cuts doing a crab and, you know, like sort of sticking the up faders
Euro
up.
Kind of thing.
And all the Euro stuff and Vegas with like some of the up fader stuff and then plus one with the agility and speed and, you know, so, and then you're stepping in, you get to the UK final and you're battling these, you know what I mean? It's like my attitude was, you know, one of contributing, one of trying to be fresh, coming through that hip-hop ethic of not biting.
And not being from London as well. You're working doubly hard to push through, cut through the noise as well, right?
It felt, yeah. I mean, obviously the UK scene is naturally London-centric. It always has been because the media's there, you know, hip-hop connections there. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's the country's capital. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So the spotlight is on London. So naturally, those DJs within that scene, that's the main focus, you know, of the rest of the UK. So being from Burnley, a small town in Lancashire, 20 miles outside of Manchester, you know, I had to work hard just to get props in Manchester. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you're getting out of town and all of a sudden you're with the big boys, you know, you're in a battle with, you know, first rate Mr. Thing and Prime Cuts.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you might have half the scratch perverts in the battle. The other half are on the judging panel.
Mm.
So if I'm going to make any noise whatsoever,
you've got
to come with it. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think that's a hunger? That is, because I'm originally from outside of London. Mm. That hunger is the drive.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, even though at the time it feels frustrating, because, you know, you might do a battle and you think, oh, well, you know, because he knows everybody and this, that, whatever it is. Yeah. You know how it is coming up.
Yeah.
And or even just the reception you get from a crowd, even though you think, well, I just did something nobody's ever done before, but, whatever.
Mate, I swear to God, I know exactly.
So you know how it is. But in retrospect, that kind of underdog element is such a driving force.
Mm.
And it is actually a buzz. Like, when you've cut through that, when you're the guy who all of a sudden, dude, like after the first time I went to UK DMC final 99, did my thing outside, like, you know, sort of northerner down with his mates doing his thing, trying to represent, you know what I mean. A month or so later I went to the first UK team championships, walking down the street in Ladbroke Grove towards Subterranea or wherever it was. DJ Pogo, Like hero.
Yeah, legend.
Hero. UK hip hop, you know, I'm a massive UK hip hop geek as well. But like, yeah, Pogo walks past me and I seen him. I'm like, that's DJ Pogo. He stopped to say what's up to me. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Some kid from Burnley who'd been buying, you know, MC Mello records from Time, do you know, all his related projects.
All the affiliates and everything.
Yeah. And he's like, Woody, innit? Props, I love your set. I was just like, dude. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's all you need. You could die and go to heaven now. That's
exactly. So like, once you cut through that and these guys you've been looking at, you know, give it your back, you're just like, oh man. And that was such a motivating factor. Yeah. So from that point, it's like, I'm not here to make up numbers.
Yeah.
I'm here to win. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I'm here to make my mark.
Come on, you know, talk that shit. That's right.
But yeah, man, just hip hop, you know what I mean? Just that drive to get better personally, but also to contribute to the culture and bring something, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Big time. Scenes outside of London tend to do that. It is the underdog effect. It's the play to win. It's the that's where I feel like that's where the creative hubs are. That's where the forging new ideas comes from. Whether it's graph, whether it's breakdancing or anything, it's like London, big shout out to my London crew, but you know us, we can sometimes get complacent because of things outside our front door. It's when you're in the back streets, in the places where we're so out, that's where the new ideas, that's where the next thing kind of is incubating.
I think it's an interesting dynamic because you know, you're growing up in a town where nobody's into what you're into, particularly if it's turntable.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, when I was skating, there might have been 20 Burnley skaters, 20, 30 Burnley skaters. There were no scratch DJs. Do you know what I mean? Like,
there was no scenes.
Dude,
there.
Like, I mean, back in the, everybody was breaking at the school disco. There was a bunch of graffiti artists. There was a bunch of people into it, mainly people I was, at the time, older than me, probably out of the circles of the headheads in my town. But so far as like those dudes listening to DJ Supreme, Hijack, trying to, I remember like from 88, I think it was about 88, when we were getting more into skating. Some of the skaters who was banging to the hip hop was kind of still into it, but not wanting to do it.
Yeah.
I was still writing rhymes, doing little graffiti and my things and whatever. It's still like Hip Hop Connection had started by that point. There was a few years where I was like the only like hip hop dude. I didn't know anybody. Do you know
the
what I mean?
The only hip hop kid in the village. Yeah, tell literally. You, man. Like, that's just real.
A couple of people liked some of the rap music, but nobody I knew wanted to do it.
Because we were both called Lee, right? See, we all had those nicknames in schools for the kids that are outsiders. Because we were outsiders, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we weren't, ambitions weren't to go to the pub and drink and listen to, you know, new wave British indie music and stuff. So I was Ice Lee.
We discovered, I was Easy Lee before Easy E.
Hold tight.
Yeah, man, before NWA came out. And my little rap crew, I made my best mate who was into heavy metal at the time, I made him get into rap and learn Run DMC lyrics. And we started, we had this little thing called the Psychic Boys, and we used to go around the schoolyard, like with like, whatever, do you know what I mean? But yeah, it wasn't till my brother went to college in 91, came back from college, and he's like, there's a lad in my class exactly the same as you. I'm like, right, what do you mean? And he brought back this getting to know your little book thing. Mm. And Chris is his name. And it was like, biggest influence, Chuck D. You know, most influential, Terminator X, or whatever. And my brother's like, yeah, and he's a DJ and he's got decks. And he lived in this little village called Barn Aldswick, just outside.
Revelationary, you know.
Oh, dude, I was like, that was after waiting, after like starting high school, I was looking for the dude with a Kangol on, whatever, looking for the person with a Public Enemy badge on, you know, just looking for them hip-hop heads, somebody to bounce off. And it took a couple of years, but like, 91, hooked up with Chris and Rick, rest in peace, Rick. All of a sudden I've got a DJ crew, you know, like I was saving up for turntables in 91, whatever, buying my records, wanting to do it, practicing on my mates. And then come 92 when I got my first set up.
It's going down.
I mean? It's like, we've got a crew. We're like the Barn Aldswick, stroke Burnley, you know, wannabe Pickles, wannabe like hijack.
And it's you against
the
world, isn't it? Because once you've defined, because then you've got rapport. Then you've got conversations. And these conversations, those are the things that spur you on. It's like coaching, isn't it?
We all had our different vibe. Like Rick was like, he's older generation, so he was like five, like round one UK. Do you know what I mean? Like electro, you know, like, yeah, could cut up super nasty on electro, like just fastest Transformers I've ever seen and stuff. Rick, like, Chris, just a couple of years older than me, but he already had decks and he could already cut. And, do you know what I mean? And we were all about the UK Britcore, like, you know, Untitled,
so
you know,
sick.
Gunshot, all them, Blade. And, you know, we're into aggressive, fast hip hop and we wanted to scratch like maniacs.
That's the shit. That's it. I've got to say, though, Woody, and I alluded to this at the start, and it holds true through the times that, because we come up through the same era. Never have I met someone so versatile that as a selector, as well as a turntablist, can transfer those skills and make it a complete 360 beeline towards instrumentalizing a turntable. Like, I remember seeing you at shows with, ranging from you with a Moog player or, you know, a Rhodes player, to you using a wah-wah pedal, to you using some crazy instrumentalists as part of a band, Russian percussion, Hold Tight, DJ Vadim. And I know you've done so many other projects, but I've never met a more superiorly skilled DJ, bro. For real, like, I mean it. Like, diluting your skill set to fall in line with other people as a cooperative in a band and things like that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, firstly, thank you. I mean,
facts, though. Come on. Don't you dare comment anything else. You know he's been putting in the work. And you do put yourself in context with other acts and artistries around you that compliments, rather than, I'm going to do like 1,000 mph scratch. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you really know how to
You don't scratch over a vocal chorus, you know? You've got to know your place in the band, you know what I mean? So it's like, so if, you're DJing for a rapper, you do what's... going to work best for that show. Do you know what I mean? You've got to put yourself in context. So it's like if I'm playing a club and trying to keep people dance, yeah, I'll put some stuff in it, but like I'm not going to go to town doing the crazy instrumental geeky X, Y, and Z that I might do for an Instagram video or for a DJ battle. You know, it's context, you know, and it's just trying to be tasteful. But I mean, I kind of got into this. I didn't get into DJing just to play clubs or just to scratch an R in a fresh. Do you know what I mean? I've like all of it excites me. Do you know what I mean? I want to be able to put a well thought out mix together and take you on a journey. I want to be able to keep people dancing and smiling in a club. I want to be able to take the turntable to new heights as an instrument. You know what I mean? There's so many little mini projects within this art form that are interesting and exciting and creatively
little pockets of scenes, which is
it keeps life interesting, man. Like, I mean, that's just me. You know, I like to work on different things, and all these aspects of this, this culture really excite me and interest me. So why not try and do your best with all of them? Do you know what I mean?
Like, well, yeah, but there are so many. I mean, there's the Porter scene, there's the battle tool genre of music making. There's like you say, and again, being here is fucking awesome because your social media platform, which highlights all your skill sets, this the meat and veg of your trade, that is most definitely a scene itself. Moving on from perverts, you know, we talked about this before, going into Tiger Styles and Scully and all these your contemporaries as well, you know, that you took that, what was the almost like the beginning of the golden era, and you transferred it into all these other newer pockets, and it did turn into a club thing. There was this burgeoning like attention wanting these elements to go into clubs, wasn't there?
Well, I mean, as you well know, like, you know, at the time we were quite lucky in the fact that this creative sort of boom in the whole scene coincided with, thankfully, kind of a resurgence in the interest of hip hop and this kind of renaissance in true school hip hop, you know, Raucous Records and all that, UK Jazz Fudge, and you know, all this, you know, the scene came back to a position where, you know, we could go out and do tours. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, I mean, those Russian percussion tour schedules. I mean, wow.
Mammoth.
Yeah. You know, so...
What holiday? What day off? Are you mad?
I'm glad I did that in my 20s anyway. Yeah, That's all I'm saying.
Big up, Vadim.
Yeah, man.
You were bonkers.
Yeah. That's why I've got grey hairs now. But yeah, I mean, luckily there was kind of, you know, if you did do well within the battle culture, there was that springboard to be able to do some touring with
transferal and get into the clubs and stuff.
Yeah, which necessarily from a certain point a few years ago, there wasn't necessarily that availability of scene, you know, like the tide shift and, you know, sort of what your sort of... I mean, a lot of it's dictated by what your 18 to early 20s are into, do you know what I mean? And we could go and do university balls and student union gigs, and because, you know, yeah, like our scene had a scene, you know what I mean?
That's right. It is seasonal, isn't it? I think everyone has their time to shine in the sun. You mentioned actually in the car that there was a real poignant moment where you discussed that the light switch went on from night to day that's where the scene's concerned.
Yeah, it was kind of, when would it be? Like early 2000, it would be like maybe 2004 or something, that kind of it, when dubstep was about to take over, basically. And yeah, we'd all been doing our thing, you know, you could have these big lineups, you know, with the Perverts, Skits, Rodney P, yourself, you know, all the guys on there. And then dubstep came along and washed its hands with like the hip hop scene, really, like, not being funny, but like I remember there was this one moment, and I can still remember it viscerally, you know, like I've got really vivid imagery of it. And I'd been working my arse off, like play in this big sort of room. There was like 2,000 people in there doing a hip hop set. Sort of, you know, I like my stuff with funk in it. So it was like, you know, pretty funky stuff or whatever. But people were dancing, people were smiling, you know, it was a vibe. But yeah, doing what I do as a scratch DJ, I was juggling this, doing that, you know, really putting the work in. And there was this guy on after me called Casper. And I'd sort of heard of him, whatever. Mm. And I knew he was dubstep, but I'd never, at that point maybe, never DJed directly before anybody playing that. Or certainly not in a big venue like that. And he came on with this sort of white label. And I'm about to pack my stuff down. It was super chilled. And just put the needle on the record and like, it was, you know. But what blew my mind wasn't necessarily that, you know, that bass. It was what it did to the crowd. Mm. And it was like the crowd just went, vroom.
Changed the whole
dynamic. Yeah, like it didn't. It was almost heartbreaking because it was like, it wasn't like you do this thing and you're presenting your skills. And that used to be a thing that everybody was like, you're DJing, everybody's crowded around the DJ box in a hip hop night. Do you know what I mean? Everybody's waiting for the showcase. Mm-hmm. You know, like that is the focus. Mm. That is like the thing that people are into. Mm. All of a sudden it's like, they're not interested how many things I juggle or how tight the juggles are or what the scratches are doing. Man, it's just that tune, you know what I mean? Like that was what...
The one thing.
And yeah, like I think that felt like a sort of a change, you know, like your sort of scratches in Edinburgh and London and No Fakings and all the sort of foundations of this scene that we'd been playing and that we'd been enjoying for the last few years. There seemed to be a shift, you know, the students were into a different thing. The promoters couldn't necessarily make profit out of those kind of nights anymore. So it was definitely an interesting time for us hip hop heads. Yeah, man.
It switched quick.
I was at the time. Oh no, it was a few years later. I was doing the band stuff straight after that. So yeah, I didn't need that for my buoyancy. But yeah, luckily, kind of, yeah, the Russian percussion. And then I went to DJ for a big Spanish hip hop star called Mala Rodriguez. And we was so luckily I had those kind of other projects to kind of keep going.
See, things that were off the socials at the time because there wasn't really any. But I'd argue, like in terms of technical ability and where it disappeared in the clubs, social media definitely made up for it as a platform where you could show off your skills or, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was interesting. I got on. I used to have a website actually. My label's called Woodwork now, and way before the label, I had a website called woodwork.com, spelled the same way as...
Oh, remember it? Yeah, that's right.
And that's where I put, pre-YouTube, I put like little, whatever, were they .rm files or whatever the video file was at the time. And that was my little platform to try and get these little ideas
that's
out.
That's so awesome. That
I was trying to put out. Because my thing, outside of the battling, was I wanted to present my ideas, you know what I mean? Like, keep the thing moving so far as turntablism, you know.
And technology, like just going back to the Casper thing and the way that impacted, you've always been ahead of the curve, and there's certain things that I bet you took away from sonically whatever the song was doing, the nature of how it was presented. I'm sure there was a lot of elements there that you could probably lean towards, even something from not so long ago that was like, actually that kind of works, it's very similar to that, what was happening back then, it's doing that now in this tune, and you can do this into that. But if you were doing it with turntablism, you could reinterpret it in a different... It feeds itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of funny how the creative process works sometimes things just kind of seep in there, sort of in the background, and then they come to fruition later on. Yeah. But yeah, you've got to be open, man. Like, even though, you know, sort of culturally, you know, hip hop is, you know, where it all comes from, I don't think you ever make any kind of interesting contribution if it's only self-referential. Do you know what I mean?
That's so right. So true.
Obviously, you know, hip-hop comes from all these different genres of music. And that's what our culture nurtures, like, you know, the sort of exploration and research of older musical forms, mm. and you know, it's like graphic design. You know what I mean? Or any art form, you're sort of taking elements and yeah. sort of doing something with it. And so I think it's like rappers who only listen to rappers, scratchers who only listen to scratching. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you open yourself up to things beyond your culture, then inevitably it's gonna come out in a way that's fresh to your culture. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Reinterpreted, twisted up, fed through. Yeah, you're right. Do you think there's a lot of feedback going on at the moment? Maybe that there should be an outside, a more outside influence. I mean, again, like I'm talking to you. You're like you create battle tools that have crazy sounds, and your mission is to not make it sound like anything. But do you think from a more general overview of the music scene, do you think there's a lot of feedback going on of similar influences and plagiarism?
That's the sort of
the plagiarism word.
In hip hop circles, that's going to like go off on a tangent,
Yeah.
But like, so far as it's a funny one these days, because you know, you'd think with the opening of, you know, sort of you can listen to anything, anytime, anywhere. You've got the internet, you've got Spotify. You'd think like influence would be super diverse, but it doesn't seem to sort of happen that way. Yeah. You know, it seems to get filtered even more. I mean, I think our role, kind of without being that narky guy on the internet whinging about everything, it is, I don't think we should be like, oh, this is the way it was and this is the way it should be.
Yeah.
But there are certain ethics within the culture of hip hop that actually encourage things to always be different, things to always be fresh.
It does by default.
Creativity,
doesn't it?
Do you know what I mean? And that is what, you know, was instilled certainly in me. And I know in you from what you do, what you've done with beatboxing, man. Like, coming with your own style, being fresh. Hate to say it, but not biting. Do you know what I mean?
Owning your own style, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, yeah, to get your levels up, you're obviously you're going to look at, you know, the certain foundational skills, and you're going to replicate your heroes and everything. But from that point, from that platform, from that sort of springboard, it's for you to take it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we still need to remind people of that, I think. I think at this sort of age and time, I think there is value for the longevity of the culture and the art form in instilling some of these, basically, I mean, it's common sense, you know what I mean? It's just a creative ethos. You
style
know?
Is everything, man.
Yeah.
Style is... We're of an age, right? And we're of an age. We've gone through the circuit. We've gone through the creative process. We've forged our own style. Then the next style comes in. I feel personally it's super important to retain your own identity. You know, and there's loads of DJs out there that are comparable to this, like Mixmaster Mike always comes with his own stuff. And it's almost like incubate. It's like time capsuled. Do you know what I mean? That's super important, isn't it? Like as an age, when you get to that point, it's like, well, if you own it, you have to own it, because if no one else is going to own it for you, you know?
Yeah.
It's super important, isn't it?
Yeah, I think... I think the advancement of skill is it's crazy hyperspeed these days with the internet and everything. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've got Qbert did the DIY DVD. Angelo's got, like, DJ Angelo, big up. He's got like really cool sort of tutorials, and you know, there's all these resources to learn all your foundational skills out there, and that's wicked, and it brings beginners up to speed super quick. Like, I remember, you know, it probably took us like 2 years from listening to Cash Money on a record to figure out how to do a chirp. Do you know what I mean? Like, we had to figure that stuff out.
Which
I think that, like, difficult process naturally brings out individuality as well into your style.
For sure.
Because you've had to figure stuff out and it takes forever. But once you've got there, you've failed a million times and you've figured out your own way to do it. So it sounds a bit different to this guy.
It's so true.
So I think when, if you've got, you know, 5,000 DJs learning one technique from one source online, it can sort of make everybody sound similar.
Yeah.
But like I say, that definitely shouldn't be a hindrance, because at the end of the day, people are getting amazing within 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, it might have taken a decade before. So once you get all that stuff, just it's experimentation and having fun with it, and, like, you know,
yeah.
don't look at it like getting to the next level of a video game. Look at it what it is. It's music. It's supposed to sound good on your ears. You know what I mean? It's yeah, like, yeah. And I think you can get so far with technicality to a point, but if, not that it's about being remembered, but if you want your output to resonate, to culturally have some kind of bearing, it needs to say something else that's not been said.
That's right. You know? That's right. That's the currency, cultural currency, isn't it? It's like owning and having that. The 10,000 hours is everything. Yeah. Like, trust the process, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's like skating, man. It's like,
I was just about to say, because yeah, I was just looking at the skateboards thinking, wow, I wonder how many times you fall. At least with the DJing, you're not breaking nothing as you're doing it.
That said, man, I spent, yeah, like, first few years I had bloody fingers, man. Like, especially when it was all transformer switches.
Yeah, how many times did you get calluses and stuff on your fingers, carpal tunnel?
First couple of years, like, we used to go, yeah, we used to hammer it, do you know what I mean? And it was all switches.
Did it all hurt? Were your wrists hurting when you... Because these are layman's questions that, you know what I mean? It's like, I've never even asked before. Did that shit hurt when you were...
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, even these days, you know, I'm a dad now, I've got two kids and everything, and, you know, I've got a lot of responsibility, so I don't practice like I used to. So if I all of a sudden I'm like, oh, man, I need to catch up again, you know, like, I need to get on it again, you know, if I'm, you know, sort of... yeah, get on it for a solid couple of hours, it might start hurting again. But I always remember kind of, yeah, when we used to go for practice sessions and you would get calluses and literally, you know, I've been cutting until I'm bleeding. Nah. Or even a couple of years ago, I was trying some sort of weird on-record kind of hand stuff, and it was a little bit off the wall, and it was experimenting, do you know what
until
I mean?
Until your hands bled, you were trying...
Yeah, I've definitely had, like, sort
mad.
Of blood. Like I say, a couple of years ago, I was trying this weird on-the-record stuff, and I was trying it, getting the sound, the sound's sounding cooler, okay, cool. Then I look at my hand, I totally hadn't realised that my fingers were bleeding, like, the top of the fingers was bleeding. It was a weird move. But, like, I was that absorbed in the creative process and trying to make it sound good, I'd not realised that, obviously, this certain part of the hand I was using had never had any... never necessarily been utilised for scratching, so it was
bonkers.
Raw skin, you know.
Bonkers. That's crazy. That's crazy.
It's fun, man. You know you're alive.
Yeah.
When you see blood.
Yeah, totally. Going back to, I mean, listen, woodwork is on fire. You've got all these different sounds packed. You've got the beatboxing. Big shout out to Ballsy, the beatbox podcast. That's my guy. But also, you know, the Porter scene and the mods that are coming in with that. These are miniature, for those of you who don't know, these are miniature turntables we can take anywhere. You could be in any environment. You're one of the key figures that is representing the sale and the creative aspects to what you can do with these, with this scene. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like woodwork is really, like, championing that shit.
Thank you, dude. Well, I'm just trying to, like, the portable scene is amazing. I mean, like, just for the fact that, you know, if you're lucky enough, a 10-year-old, you know, with the price barrier has gone so much lower than when I was a kid. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, for 100, 120 quid, if your 10-year-old really wants to learn to scratch, and you can afford it, then boom, you're away. Mm-mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's like at least 50% of what the most basic belt drive setup would have cost. Mm. When I was that age, there was no way I could have been. If I could have had something to scratch on it at 10, dude, I was creating Run DMC Beats to the Rhyme routines on my mum and dad's MIDI hi-fi at 10, mm-hmm. do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, like, give me a portable turntable with a crossfader in it. Oh, my God.
See you later. You
know, yeah. Yeah. Like, so it's amazing for that, because I think DJing, unfortunately, has always had an economic barrier, you know, whether it's buying the records or the equipment.
It was not cheap. Now, it weren't cheap to enter.
Especially with the new era of digital stuff. It's like, what? Like, £2,000 for the latest DJ mixer, and we're trying to tell kids to start DJing?
Mm.
On top of that, they're going to need two turntables and a £2,000 Mac laptop.
Yeah. Fuck that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, us working class kids.
I feel you. Yeah.
That ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That was half the problem. You know, to know a DJ or to know someone with an MPC player, they were like, where did you come from? What planet were you from?
Like,
mad.
Yeah, man. Like, I was saving. I remember I got £1.50 pocket money for, not pocket money, school meal money at school. And I figured out how I could feed myself for the 50p and save the quid. Mm-hmm. So at the end of 5 days at school, I'd have a fiver that I could buy a 12 with at the end of the week. And that's not like, you know,
trust me, this is weekly. This is everything we're seeing behind here in the visual here, all the records, you know, this is top to tail, blood, sweat, and no school dinners.
but I think that was a natural filtration process that those who really wanted it did it. Do you know what I mean?
True.
Do
you think that will come? Do you think that still does that filtering system still apply to people in a porter scene? Because, like you say, that the margin of the price is down.
You know what? I think it's great for whatever level of dedication you want to put into it.
Mm.
Because I'm sure there's a ton of people out there who had mates when they went to uni who DJed, never did it because it was so expensive or whatever, but always fancied having a bit of a go. So there'll be people out there whose first turntable, who are my age, whose first turntable is a portable turntable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden, oh yeah, I fancy having a go at that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they can just have fun with it. Mm. Or for the more serious guys, you know, all of a sudden you can actually jam on a street corner like the rappers always could. Or you can meet up in a park with dudes and jam. Mm. Or, you know, like, it just keeps it fun. Or, you know, or you can have, like, a turntable in a room you wouldn't have before. Or, so
it's like acoustic, it's like acoustic, isn't it? It's like acoustic guitar.
It's wicked. And it's fun. And, like, for once, the community is actually dictating where the scene goes, technologically speaking, because you've got like these dudes like Jesse Dean, and there's a bunch of different people who are making the mods, who are making the turntables into like a more solid product for the turntablist, and getting them closer to being like, you know, like you've got all sorts of platters you can put on them to get more stable and X, Y, and Z. And it's cool because, you know, people with a bit of knowledge in this arena, you know, whether it's like an engineering thing or, you know, they've got a 3D printer or whatever, you know, we're making the mods that we want to see, you know.
That's so, it reminds me of a skater scene, actually. It does.
DIY, it's punk, and we're flipping the roles, because I think for too long the DJ companies have had too much influence on what we do as DJs, you know. Okay, we've got to get a new product out this year, so we've got to have 10 new features. And then all of a sudden, you've got like thousands of DJs sort of basing what they do creatively for the next 10 months on the new kit that just came out, rather than the other way around, where, you know, don't get me wrong, there are still DJ companies that listen to DJs.
Yeah.
But, it should always be the DJs that dictate where this goes creatively and technologically, I think.
Which has always been the order of the day, ever since turntablism came, since the Cuba era of, you know, the battle tools and whatnot. You know, the ownership of tech in a creative sense is super important, particularly in the DJ world, isn't it?
Yeah, man. Like, and don't forget the technics. This whole turntablism thing shouldn't even be a thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, the technics was made for playing records on radio or whatever in a club. And, you know, and Theodore and Flash and all, they took this thing and did something new with it and did something that shouldn't be done. Mm. I think that's always been the magic. That's why, you know, watching whatever, Kid Koala do like a solo on a technics.
Hold tight, Kid Koala. There's a name that ain't been out there. Come on, hold tight.
And like, big influence on me, like, through his musicality as well. Mm. And that's the magic. That's why, you know, if you're into this thing, that's why it can seem even more impressive to see a person use a turntable truly as a musical instrument and flex it and flip something. Mm. That's why it can like give you that feeling, even more so than necessarily than watching a good piano player play the piano, because that shouldn't be done. Like, that is a turntable. What's he doing with it?
Even now it's the case. Or what is that thing he's using? That's still, that's baffling as well, you know.
Mixmaster Mike, Cuba, you know, like all these dudes, you're just like, it feels magical when you see that, you know what I mean?
And that applies to you as well. If you guys haven't checked out Woody, then you know where to go. The social's on fire right now. And Woodwork as well.
Yeah, woodworkrecords.com. That's the label. And they're just trying to make products that I would want. Do you know what I mean? Like, so yeah, there's the portable stuff, like trying to make fun, put cool samples on sevens, you know. I'm a graphic designer as well. I love artwork. So I either design it all myself, or there's a couple of people. My mate Gary, Dusty Pixels, has done some garbage pail type
vibes.
and Foz from Heroin Skateboards, old Burnley skater, who's like one of the biggest artists in the skate scene, basically. I love his style. It's sort of punk, sort of scratchy, zine-y style.
And you're saying you master in London, don't you?
Air Studios, man. Like, yeah, we've got...
Proper high-spec shit, man.
Yeah. The dude who cuts all the records has done, like, Beatles records, Prince records, Madonna, like, all the things, and he's making my scratch records.
That's so sick.
Yeah. So, but just trying to do everything myself, put it all together, and just trying to make nice products for people.
That's the fun bit, though, isn't it? When you're doing cottage industry again, it's just so much... Control is everything, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, being in this industry, kind of... I mean, there's a certain... Some people are great at delegating. I don't know if I'm a bit of a control freak. I like to have hands on everything, basically. And you've kind of got to be in this scene as well to a certain extent.
To know the landscape and where you're walking.
Mm. Yeah, man, and just be self-sufficient, you know, and do it all in-house. But on a deeper level, trying to make the scratch records that can encourage a musical sort of outlook on this whole project. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's so sick.
You know, make records for turntable musicians rather than just your R's and your freshers and stuff. There's a place for that, and it's fun, and it's practicing, and it's jamming. But yeah, let's keep going with this as an instrument. Do you know what I mean? We've only been doing it 40 years. Mm. It's got some legs yet. Mm. Do you know what I mean? There's heights to which there's, you know, it can go on and on. So recording musicians, creating records specifically for turntablists to be more musical. Yeah. Basically making things that I want as a punter.
Which is everything. That's the most important ingredient. And it takes people like myself, like you, like other people that have walked that life and know what A is missing, B what people would like if it was there. Some people don't even know what they want yet until it's presented to them. So hats off to you, man, and the woodwork stuff, you know.
Trying, dude.
The future's bright, my brother.
Hope so, man, as long as we can keep happy and keep creative and stuff and keep pushing it as much as we can.
Yeah. Thank you for having me in the spot, man. I mean, it's a sunny day out there.
Beach time.
The family are waiting, you know what I mean? We've kept this one going, but thank you so much for having me, brother. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming on the podcast, man.
Thank you for coming to Mikasa, dude.
Yeah, man. I tell you what, it's been a long time coming, man. We've actually been planning to do this for a while, haven't we?
Yeah, we've been chatting for a bit. But
we made it work. We made it work.
Definitely.
My guy. Ladies and gentlemen, DJ Woody, what more can we add, yeah? Then a flight visit over here. When you're in town, you know what I mean? Come to the Mecca. Come to the turntable Mecca up north. Big shout out, Woody. Hold tight, everybody. Don't forget, sharing is caring. Share it all the way, all right? Don't talk to anyone I wouldn't. Stay lucky, people. Peace.